First, you probably know the bad news already. Mint has shut down. But here's the good news. There's a better alternative. Monarch Money. That's right. Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it. As a finance nerd, you would assume that I have my money game all together. Well, shocker, I didn't. Until Monarch Money. Monarch Money allowed me to easily see what is going on with my finances, help me get a better handle on my spending, budgets, and more. It's my go-to app every day, more so than my bank, because I can quickly see where I am with my budgets and spending, allowing me to invest more and spend time on things I want to do. It's my GPS for money. Monarch is the top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. Create custom budgets, set goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now you get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/beginners. Monarch has a tool that allows you to easily import your data from Mint and keep all your tags and categories. Monarch is the most customizable budgeting app. Change the layout of your dashboard, toggle between light and dark mode, create custom budgets and notifications, set up automatic rules for transactions and notifications, and more. Monarch is obsessed with constantly improving the product. They release updates every 2 weeks and allow customers to submit suggestions, vote on requested features, and view the product roadmap. In fact, Monarch Money is one of the first to bring you direct Apple Card, Apple Cash, and savings syncing with the latest iOS 17.4 update. Now you can sync your wallet directly for seamless budgeting. After trying out Monarch for myself, I understand why it's a top-rated personal finance app. And right now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/beginners. That's monarchmoney.com/beginners for your extended 30-day free trial. When it comes to financial advice, you got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever was in my wallet, but I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
What's the best way to get started in the market? Download Andrew's ebook for free at stockmarketpdf.com.
Love this podcast because it crushes your dreams of getting rich quick.
They actually got me into reading stats for anything.
You're tuned in to the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Led by Andrew Sather and Dave Ahern.
Step-by-step premium investing guidance for beginners.
Your path to financial freedom starts now.
Starts now.
Welcome to Investing for Beginners podcast. Tonight we have episode 207. Tonight we are going to answer some great listener questions we got recently. So without any further ado, I will go ahead and read the first question and we'll go ahead and do our usual give and take. So this great question is from Kristen. She says, "Hi there. I came across your show via Airwave as I listened to another show on the network and I'm so glad I found you. I have a tricky question and would appreciate any insight. I have owned my home in Los Angeles for the last five-ish years, and the value has jumped. I owe about $470,000 on the mortgage, and it's worth about $950,000. With mortgage interest rates so low, my current rate is 2.8%. What are your thoughts about doing a cash-out refinance and investing the cash into stocks? Thanks in advance for any guidance. Kristen." Andrew, what are your thoughts on Kristen's question?
Should we define a cash-out refinance first?
Sure. Tell them what it is.
Maybe you should, banker guy.
Okay, I'll do my best. I have never worked with the cash out refis, but I believe the way that they work is when you sell your home or when you do a refinance, you take out the difference from what the home is worth
versus what you owe, and then you owe an additional money on top of that. So in other words, in her circumstance, she would be able to get around $480,000 out of her home, because that's the difference between what she owes and what the value of the home is currently, which means that she would take out another mortgage, in essence, of $480,000 at 2.8%. So her question is that, would you take that refinance and reinvest it into the stock market? So what would you do?
The problem is that was the logic a lot during the mid-2000s, and it especially peaked up during 2006, 2007. The idea was that houses and home prices always go up, and they completely, totally did until the time that they didn't. And so if you were somebody who did something like a cash out refinance, you now owed more money. And if you didn't have that money on deck, basically to pay back, now you have higher payments and nothing to show for it. So as an example, if you would have taken that $400,000, put it in the stock market at the same time that the stock market crashes, so does the value of your home. You still got these higher payments to pay from having a refinance. And if you wanted to sell out your stocks, you could, but you'd be selling at a loss. For me, being so risk averse and knowing and having that be such a recent memory of what could go wrong when you take money out of a mortgage and use it to put it in the stock market, I'm just very against something like that.
I would probably agree with that. I think so. A couple things to think about if you're looking at doing something like this. So first of all, you already know what your hurdle rate is. You're going to have to earn at least better than 2.8%, whatever your refinance would be on the mortgage. So let's say it comes back at 3.5%, because maybe rates go up when you do this, or maybe they go down a little bit and you get a better rate. At the minimum, you're going to have to earn at least that to make your money back. The other thing, I guess there's two other things that kind of pop into my head. Number one is, at the $470,000 that you still owe on the mortgage, it depends on what your payment is. Let's say it's $1,000 a month, just throwing out a number. Let's say it's $1,000 a month and you take on this, in essence, new mortgage. Your payment's not going to stay at $1,000 a month. It's probably going to go up. And you have to weigh whether that is something that still will work with your budget. So that's something to consider. The other thing to consider is that now, let's say that you do the refinance, you take all the money out, and you're sitting on $480,000, and burning a hole in your pocket. You got to do something with it. Putting $480,000 into the stock market right away, for me, is a scary proposition, because A, if you lump sum all that into the stock market right now, you're basically going to have to find 10 to 100 great ideas. And that's going to be really hard to do. And Andrew and I struggle to do that once a month. So let alone try to do that 200, 100 or 10 times or 20 times. That's a tall order. So then you have to consider, let's say you dollar cost average over the course of a year, and you're going to put in, what did that be, $40,000 a month, which is, it's a lot. It's a big chunk of change too, of course, but it's also, depending on how you want to split that up, you're still having to come up with more ideas. So if you come up with one idea a month and you put in $40,000 a month, okay, fine. And that's all fine and dandy. But when you're trying to work with all that, it's a lot to manage. But then you also have the other point of fact, is that if you put $40,000 in one month and you still have $440,000 more to put in over the course of the next 11 months, you got to put that money somewhere. So if you put it in a savings account, and it's earning, with that kind of money, you could probably get your interest rate up to maybe 1% if you're lucky, maybe 2%. That's still less than what you're making, than what you're paying on your interest for your loan at your current loan rate. And so I would think that there would be different options available. And this is something we talked about with the 401k a few weeks ago. What about the idea of, let's say that your mortgage is $1,000 a month and you want to refinance and your mortgage is going to go up to $1,500 a month. Instead of taking on the debt and then sitting on all that money and trying to figure out what you want to invest in, why don't you take the $500 if you can afford it, or maybe more, and throw that in the market every month and buy something with that every month? And use that as a way to build your wealth, because the other thing you want to consider is the opportunity cost of the loss of not having that option. God forbid something goes wrong and you lose your job, or you need that money for something else, and now you've put it all on the stock market. Now you have to do other things to take all that money out, and it costs you money to do all those things. So there's other considerations to think about. And I would think, for me personally, I would want to look at not taking on more debt to put money into the stock market, because there's so many things that can go wrong in the stock market. And I'm not trying to be, Captain Negative here, but I'm trying to think about the positive and the negatives. And you have to think about, it'd be exciting to have $500,000 to be able to put into the stock markets. That's a big chunk of change, and that could really do some things. But if you choose poorly, or if you buy at the wrong time over the next year, then you could really set yourself up for a big hurt. And it also depends on what kinds of things you buy. If you're buying middle of the road companies, safe, stable, boring, air quote, boring companies, like a Walmart or Target or something along those lines, you're going to do fine. But if you start throwing money at some of these super exciting, shiny objects that are in the stock market that everybody's talking about today, but a year and a half from now are the dogs of the Dow kind of thing, then it could set yourself up for a lot of hurt. For me personally, you got to remember, I'm a little older. I'm also more conservative. So for me personally, I would rather look at other options that can still get me into the market and put good money in the market. $500 to $1,000 a month is nothing to sneeze at. And over a very short amount of time, that could build up quickly and can add up to some serious returns. Plus, it gives you the opportunity to continue doing that over the life of however long you want to invest. Whereas if you do the cash out refi, now you're stuck in that house too for another 10 or 15 years too before you can pay it off, depending on what your mortgage is and what your payments are. We don't have all the information here for Kristen, but I think those are some things that I think of that maybe are a little more alternative ideas than just doing a cash out refi and using the money that way. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I completely agree. And a lot of it comes down to this idea that you only want to put money into the market that you don't need in the next 5 to 10 years. And the problem with personal finance is it's so personal. And the other problem with it is we can plan for how we think our life's going to be 5 years from now, 10 years from now. That doesn't make it happen. If you look around at the people around you, how many people do you have gone through a divorce or had some crazy medical thing pop up? Something like 70% of bankruptcies had to do with medical bills.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. So what are the factors? A surprise layoff. The pandemic, right? So all these things that just can pop up out of nowhere. And that's really the big risk you take when you try to do something tricky and try to speed up your getting rich process by taking on debt. It works fine and the math works great, but life doesn't work like math does all the time. And so when that downside is so potentially huge and you have to face this idea of, if I just hold on while the market's going down, I'm going to do fine, but I can't hold on because I need to sell because this came up. So that's why you never want to borrow to go into the market, because it could force you to make decisions like this. And at the end of the day, that's the worst thing that you could do in the stock market, is to take it out when everybody else is selling too, because maybe they're all dealing with similar types of things. So that's why you want to put money in the market that you can afford to lose, and just let it sit and let it compound. And that's how you'll do well with building wealth in the stock market.
Amen, brother. That's fantastic advice. You said that very well.
Thank you. We'll move on to the next question then. I'm going to read this one here. It says, "Hi, Andrew and Dave. Been listening to the podcast for over a year now. Love the content and the chemistry you guys have. He loves learning about investing so much that he decided to move careers." That's really cool. "Enough about me. The Intelligent Investor in chapter 15, the commentary, Jason Zweig basically says, as an amateur, your best bet is to put your money in mutual funds and keep no more than 10% of your portfolio in direct equities. He says, I know you guys love this book and use a lot of the principle it teaches. And from what I've heard on the podcast, neither of you have capital in activity managed mutual funds. Is there any reason why you don't follow this rule of thumb? And why don't either of you invest in mutual funds or promote mutual funds in the podcast? Keep up the great work, Rob from London."
Hey, Rob from London. That was a great question. And thank you for referring to the chapter in our favorite book. We did turn our pages in the hymnal before we came on to read that quote. We did. We are that kind of nerd. And so we did read his commentary. And by the way, that is one of the gems of the book, is you get all the great stuff from Ben Graham, but you also get a lot of the great stuff from Jason as well. He's one of the best finance writers out there. If you've not read any of his stuff, I highly recommend you check it out. It's fantastic. And it's great commentary to the book as well. He did in the book, he talked about kind of two processes. One was doing a paper trading account for a year. And then if that does well for you, then you consider start actively investing in equities. And if you are not comfortable investing in equities, then he recommended doing index funds and 10% in direct equities, like basically, you know, individual stocks and that kind of thing. And I think that's great advice. And we've talked about this before. There's nothing wrong with doing that. For some reason, there's this stereotype that you either have to be all in stocks or none. And you can mix and match however works best for you. Andy Schuler, our partner, he talks all the time about different ETFs that he's bought when he wants to start exposure in a space. For example, prior to COVID, I think he bought Jets because he wanted to get into some of the airlines and dip his toe into that. And it's a great way to do that kind of thing. And there's so many different ETFs and index funds out there available. For me personally, the reason why I've stayed away from mutual funds is, without being too blunt, fees. They're expensive. They're actively managed funds and they're expensive. And when I say expensive, I compare mutual funds. It's changed a little bit in response to what's going on with ETFs and index funds, but generally they're higher fees, 2-3% sometimes, that get taken out of your returns. And then they're actively managed, so they're lots of activity inside the funds. And I just don't feel like the returns on those funds have been anything to write home about. Now, of course, there are fund managers out there that do a great job, and I'm not trying to bash any of the fund managers out there, but studies have shown that index funds and ETFs earn better returns over a longer period of time than mutual funds have. And when you take fees into consideration, it beats them even more. So for me, that's why I've never really talked about them, and I've always been against them. So what are your thoughts on them?
Yeah, I think it's obvious that ETFs are superior to mutual funds based on the fees. And even if you look at Cathie Wood's ETF, it's basically what a mutual fund used to be, except mm-hmm. now you can buy it as an ETF. And there's just so much, that next evolution of cost structure has now moved towards ETFs. And obviously people are going to want to go where there's less fees. And so that's why I think mutual funds used to be a lot more popular when we first started out. And lately it's been more talking about ETFs, index and stuff like that. So yeah, that's kind of why I'm in that camp. I think when you look at that mix between how comfortable do you feel between individual stocks and index funds or ETFs, whatever that looks like, it goes back to that beginning of the episode where we say your personal comfort level, what you find to be comfortable from a risk perspective. For me, because I've been very involved with the stock market and with the research I'm doing on these picks, I'm very comfortable with putting my whole net worth into them. And that's what I do. I recommend these stocks for the e-letter, and over 95, 96, 97, whatever number is, percent of my net worth also goes into these same picks. And so that, for me, it sounds conservative to me, and I'm comfortable with it. To somebody else, that might sound crazy. So you really have to figure out where you stand on that and position your portfolio that way, but also be familiar with what are the possibilities and what are the positives and negatives to doing stuff like that. And hopefully we're able to present those in our show and the various episodes we've done.
Yeah. I think thinking about some of those ideas, you really need to think about what you're comfortable doing. And if you really enjoy the game of investigating companies and learning the ins and outs of the companies and how they operate and their prospects and their competitive moats and what comp- competition there is among the different companies. If all that stuff is super interesting to you and you love doing that stuff, then looking at individual stocks is something for you. But if you know that you want to invest and you don't want to spend that time, or that stuff just leaves you cold, then there's all kinds of great opportunities and vehicles that you can use to still take advantage of all the great things that the stock market has to offer that allow you to get the great returns that you want, but not have to do all the work that Andrew and I do. We do it because we love it. We do it because we like it. It's fun and exciting. It helps us wake up every morning. Some people, they just don't like that. And that's okay. There's not all of us are built the same. We all have different risk levels. We all have different interest levels. And there's lots of people out there that put money in index funds or ETFs and do it religiously every month, and they retire very wealthy, and they're very happy with spending 5 minutes a day or 5 minutes every month looking at their portfolio, and that works for them. And that's awesome. That for me, that's, I want more. And so I want to do more. I want to look at more. I want to be more active about it, and I want to have more control and more say over it. And so that's what works for me. But it really comes down to what works for you. And Andrew and I will never sit here and tell you that this is the right way and that's the right way and this is the wrong way and that's the wrong way. We'll just give you the ideas that we think will work best for us. And if you like what we're talking about, then you'll listen to us and you'll follow along. But we also will talk about other options as well. The bottom line is, it doesn't matter that you follow everything that we do the way that we do it. Really, it comes down to learning the principles and learning how the stock market works and learning how to put your money to work for you so that you don't have to work so hard someday. And it doesn't matter how you get there. And if it's investing in individual stocks like we do, or if it's index funds or mutual funds or your 401k, then more power to you, because that's really what it comes down to.
Let's face it. A vibrant sex life contributes significantly to your overall happiness and confidence, but sometimes your hectic schedule doesn't leave room for doctor visits. That's where Hims steps in. With their convenient and discreet online platform, you can receive treatment for erectile dysfunction from the comfort and privacy of your own home. No more waiting rooms, no more awkward conversations, just a simple, direct path to treatment that works around your life, not interrupts it. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. Hims provides access to doctor-trusted ED treatment options such as chewable hard mints, brand-name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor visits. Answer a series of questions on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance is needed. If ED is getting you down, it's time you join hundreds of thousands of trusted Hims subscribers and get treated. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/investing. That's hims.com/investing for your personalized ED treatment options. hims.com/investing. Hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription needed. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
Amen. Okay. But that was a great question, Rob. So we appreciate you reaching out to us and letting us know about that. All right. We'll move on to the next question here. Hey, Dave and Andrew. First off, thank you both for what you do. I stumbled upon your podcast with no knowledge of investing at all. Now I feel like I have the ability to set myself up for retirement. Long-term value/dividend investing just makes sense to me. I have a few questions for you guys. This might be one more up Dave's alley. I recently invested in a bank. Woohoo! Actually, one of your e-letter picks. With the recent news of impending interest rate hikes, I've seen banking stocks plummet in the last few days. Is the interest rate hike going to be a concerning long-term problem for banks, or would this be a good time to buy more stocks and lower my cost average per share? So in a word, yes, this would be a good time to take a look at banks. When interest rates go up, that's actually a good thing for banks, because a large majority of the income that they make is from interest rates. So there's several ways to think about this. So the first is, banks make a difference. It's called net interest income. And basically what it is, it's a spread between what you borrow and what they have to pay people to loan them money. So in other words, if you pay 10% for a car loan and they pay 2% for a savings account, that 8% difference is their income. That's the money that they make. And so when banks take deposits from us, whether it's in a savings account or a checking account or money market CD, any of those kinds of things, that is raw material for them to lend out to other people to try to make money off of that money that they're lending. And so the more that they can lend and at the higher interest rates that they can lend, or the bigger the spread between the rates that they can charge people for loaning them money and the rates that they have to pay to entice people to make deposits, that's how they make their income. That's the majority of it. It depends on the bank, but it's about 50-50, maybe 60-40. It kind of depends on the bank. The other way the banks make money is on other services that they offer, like wealth management or investments or things of that nature. And they charge fees for those things. And that's how they make money. Contrary to popular belief, they actually don't make that money from overdraft fees. So there is that. I know that's very unpopular, obviously, but
only make a little.
But not as much as people think. And trust me, I work for Wells Fargo. We used to charge a lot of overdraft fees, and I know. So, but anyway, that's beside the point. But when interest rates go up, that's actually a good thing for banks. And the reason why the stocks have been hitting lately is because it's more, I think, about some of the concerns with COVID recently. But interest rates, when they do go up, that will be a boon for banks and insurance companies for sure.
Couldn't you argue that the more dry powder a bank has, the better, the higher interest rates would be for them? Let's say some of these loan to deposit ratios, like almost 100%.
Yeah.
So even if rates went higher, they don't have any, not that they don't have any, but they don't have as much cash to lend out as maybe somebody with a much more conservative balance sheet with a lot more cash that could take advantage of the higher rates and loan out and be more aggressive with that.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's a perfect illustration. The more dry powder that the bank has, the better that's going to be for them in the long run. And that's really why banks have really struggled since 2007, 2009, is the interest rates have remained so low. During the great financial crisis in 07, 09, the rates went to almost zero, and that just almost killed the banks. Now, the opposite of that is a lot of the banks were at fault for everything happening. You can't really blame, but ever since then, the rates really never went up. And so because of that, it's really depressed the earnings ability for a lot of banks over the last, 10, 13 years that this has been going on. And that's why banks have actually started moving towards other forms of trying to generate revenue away from more the traditional lending aspect of it, because they just haven't been able to generate as much income from them. Now, some of the big banks like Wells Fargo, for example, they have actually been put under an asset cap restriction. In other words, that means that the bank can only grow so big and they're not allowed to take on more loans to drive up their asset cap because of all the bad stuff that they did a few years ago with all the fraudulent opening accounts and credit accounts and all that stuff. And it's just been, they keep stepping on just about every other week, it seems like, for a few years there. Anyway, because the Fed put a limit on how big the bank could get, and that also means that it puts a limit on how much money they can loan, and it puts a limit on how much money they can make. So they've been in a penalty box for a few years, and it could last for a little bit longer. But other banks like JP Morgan, for example, have just absolutely killed it over the last 4 or 5 years. And they've done a fantastic job. But they've really diversified their bank, and they've moved away from relying so much on deposits and loans to drive their revenues. And they've tried to use other aspects of the banking industry to generate revenues. Yeah, it's a great question. But I think banks, if interest rates do start to rise, would be a great place to look for opportunities.
I think as the way I feel personally about it, depending on the valuation, I think it's in general always a pretty good idea to buy banks over the long term, just because what's the one constant in an economy
is bank.
Money.
Yeah.
So, that the form of the bank, whether it's online or brick and mortar, that could change over time. But at the end of the day, money has to sit somewhere. It's got to sit at a bank. And so long term, this is something like it, something that kind of opened my eyes to this. When I looked at Buffett had that quote where he said the companies from 30 years ago that were the top in the S&P versus the top companies today, they're way different.
Yeah,
but if you look at 10 years ago, like before the financial crisis, there's a few kind of unicorn companies like Google, or maybe Google wasn't on there. I think it's like Apple and Microsoft.
Yeah.
They were the big boys back then. They're the big boys now. But like the other companies that are along that, the only other ones that were consistent, Wells Fargo and Bank of America. Yep. Maybe JP Morgan. I can't remember if they were there, but it's a similar kind of concept. As these things grow and they become, they just need to stay a part of the economy. They can continue to help money flow through the economy. And so as long as they got good balance sheets, good companies, and they trade at good valuations, they could be good buys a lot of the time, and not just because somebody thinks interest rates are going to go up right now.
Yeah, exactly. There's a few other advantages that banks offer as well. Number one is they generally are pretty stable companies. They generally don't have lots of huge fluctuations in prices and stuff. I mentioned a while ago that I had bought some Palantir, which is one of the AI companies out there. And my goodness, the volatility in that thing is it's worse than a roller coaster. And if you can stomach that, fine. And it's a very small portion of my portfolio, so it's nothing to get excited about. But anyway, the point is that owning something like Bank of America or JP Morgan is generally far less volatile. So you're not going to wake up one day and see it down 22% and the next day up it's 18% and the next day it's down 11%. You're just not going to see that kind of fluctuations. So there's that part of it. The other thing is that they pay dividends, and they generally pay pretty good dividends, and they consistently pay dividends over very long periods of time. They also have been doing lots of share buybacks. They didn't during COVID, but they're starting to do those again. And so there's great opportunities with that. I think a lot of people stay away from banks simply because they are either told to, or they are afraid of kind of the banking language. So when you look at financials for banks, it's not the same as looking at a financial for Walmart or Apple. It's different. And at first it could be confusing and a little bit overwhelming, but once you start to understand the language and how the banks operate, then it becomes a lot easier to assess them and decide whether they would be a good fit for you or not.
What's great about it is once you learn about it once, you have that circle of competence to build on, and so you don't have to learn it again. But I agree, it is not for the faint of heart.
Mm-hmm. No, no, it's not.
Nobody's going to fault you if you've passed on the banks.
Yeah, no, not at all. Not at all. But one thing I do want to point out is almost 20% of the S&P 500 is financials. So if you just automatically ignore financials, you're automatically ignoring almost 20% of the S&P as a possible investment opportunity. So there is that to consider.
Nothing wrong with trying to expand your circle of competence over time.
No, but again, not trying to pressure.
So the last part of the question here, he says, also, I've been having a little trouble trying to determine the impact that COVID had on certain companies. For example, looking at a company like NHC, National Healthcare Corporation. They are basically an elderly care company. My evaluations of the company look very promising up until 2020. Obviously, they were probably affected immensely by COVID. They were also given a lot of government aid that carried them through the year. Should I take 2020 as an outlier and be bullish on the fact they survived it and still have little debt, or be worried they had to rely on government aid to make it through the rough patch? Any help would be much appreciated. Thanks again, and keep the knowledge flowing, Cody.
That's a great question, Cody. And I think COVID is definitely an outlier, and it has been an outlier, and it probably continues to be an outlier. It appears through at least maybe the rest of this year. It's something you have to take into consideration. I know that when I've been looking at different companies over the last year or so, that a lot of them have been recently, depending on how they are impacted by COVID, are either downplaying the boost it gave them or upplaying the downturn that they took and how much they're bouncing back from it. So, for example, if there was a company that really got smacked by what happened to COVID. Maybe they were in a position where they had to shut down their operations for a period of time and things really took a hit, but then bounced back and now are humming along great. Then they try to average out, they'll average out their returns over the last few years, and they'll talk about their income or their revenues over a 2-year period or over a 3-year period. A lot of people I've been noticing on earning calls have been commenting on, we are now back to 2019 levels, or we're doing better than we were in 2019. So it's just ignoring what happened in 2020 because it was such an abnormality. And I think for me, that's what I've really been trying to do, is look at each company individually and not wash over a whole sector or a whole industry and just take it on a case by case basis. So if NHC is a company that you felt was doing great in 2019, COVID hit, it obviously impacted them by what you're telling us, and it looks like they're bouncing back, then you can look and see where they were compared to 2019. And if they're bouncing back well and the company is even doing better than they were in 2019, then obviously that was an outlier and you just treat it as such. But it could also be a situation where, I'm not saying this is the case, but it could also be a situation where it exposed a weakness in the business. And maybe they've bounced back, but maybe they're not bouncing back as well as they were before. And that might be something that you would want to investigate further before you decide whether you want to jump in with both feet and buy the company. So those are some things that kind of popped in my mind. I'm curious to hear what Andrew has, his thoughts.
I think it's tough. And I think in general, you don't want to like make exceptions. So as an example, like if I'm looking at a company and I see the numbers and there's some explanation why the numbers are bad, or there's some explanation why we think they're going to rebound, generally you want to stick more toward the facts than anything else. But because COVID is such, it's tough because everybody has their own opinions on it. They have even different opinions on how long they think it's going to last or what impacts it will have. And so that's why I like this idea of taking it by a case by case basis. So to look at a company like this, you have to ask yourself a question. I think the bigger question as a long-term investor is the fact that COVID happened, obviously it happened, but is the fact that it happened, does that affect the demand for elderly care over the long term? So is this fact that we've gone through COVID, could go through it again, or have gone through it and we're finished? But whether you see a future where we have a second wave, third wave, whatever, or you see a future where it's completely behind us, has what has happened so far, is that going to change the behavior or the demand for elderly care? And then how is that going to affect a company like this? When you contrast that to maybe another example would be like an amusement park company where they had COVID. Is the fact that there was COVID before keeping people from going to the amusement parks when they are open? And so a similar question, but different, because we're looking at two different cases that are both heavily affected by COVID, but the fact that demand in one industry could be changed permanently regardless of what the COVID future is, whereas another demand could be unaffected at all and could only be maybe possibly only affected if we have future lockdowns. And then you could have a third company, which have been a lot of great companies, where this whole thing hasn't affected them at all. In fact, it's boosted them. And so any further uncertainty is only a plus to their stock. So that's why you have to look at it a case-by-case basis. And so it is an outlier, but it's one of those weird outliers where if it changes the fundamentals of a business, and it could be something as simple as the fact of people do not want to buy this or go to this service for any reason, and it's because of what COVID has done. It could be that simple, but that could really, I think, help you a lot in a time like this where so much is under change.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Think about, Andrew Graves gave some great examples. Think about how the movie theaters have been impacted by COVID. And think about how that's affected Disney Plus on the flip side of that. And both of them have been impacted by COVID, but in completely opposite directions. And it doesn't look like movie theaters, at least at this point, it doesn't look like they're bouncing back. And you compare that to what's going on with Disney Plus, and it's just continuing to excel and excel and excel. So you have to think about how that impacts the business that you're trying to analyze. And the question that Andrew asked about, is elderly care demand going to be affected by what happened with COVID now and into the future? And I don't have that answer, but that's the question you have to figure out, and how that could impact this company. Because if that's what they're basing their business on, then it's obviously a huge impact, and it's something you have to consider. And that's, I think, the bottom line is you have to look at it case by case and ask the question of, is this, did COVID fundamentally impact how this business operates, and what it is that they offer, is that going to continue to be in demand now and into the future? And if it is, then you can move from there analyzing the company. If it's not, then you have to decide, do you want to spend a lot of time looking at something that you're not really sure about, or is it something you want to try to find some other opportunity out there? And I think that's really the biggest question is elderly care going to continue the demand for that now and into the future? And if it is, what other impacts could COVID have on that that would affect the operations of NHC? Because those are things you have to consider as well. Are they going to have to take on more staff? Are the regulatory requirements going to be much, much stringent, more stringent? Is that going to impact their profitability of the company? The ability to get government aid to help them with this is not a negative, but if it's something that they can only survive on that, then that could be an issue as well. So those are all questions that you want to ask. And that's, I think, the biggest thing to take away from this is trying to think beyond just the number part of it and think about the what impacts it's had on the business and what could impact it going forward and the demand going forward, and just start making questions and then trying to figure out the answers, because that's really the best way you're going to learn and figure out how this could affect you now and into the future.
I had a quote pop up into my head. I know it was either Buffett or Charlie Munger. I can't remember what it was exactly, but I'll just try to paraphrase. Basically, you don't get any extra points for difficulty or for solving difficult investment problems. And so there's no shame and no change really to investment results, whether you pick a no-brainer business versus one that takes a million points of analysis. You can hit the exact same point. And so keep that in mind too, if it all sounds overwhelming.
Yeah, a 10% return is a 10% return. It doesn't matter. You don't get style points for picking for analyzing the hardest business out there versus analyzing the easiest business out there, whatever that may be. Yeah, that's a great quote. All right, folks. Well, that is going to wrap up our conversation for this evening. I wanted to thank everybody for taking the time to send us those fantastic questions. Again, keep it coming. Those are awesome stuff, and we really enjoy taking the time to answer these for you, and we hope you guys are getting some good takeaways from all this and some good information. Follow us on Twitter. We just started a Twitter account, IFB_podcast, and it's a great way to reach out to us if you are looking to connect with us. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and sign us out. If you guys go out there and invest with a margin of safety, emphasis on the safety, have a great week. We'll talk to you all next week.
We hope you enjoyed this content. 7 Steps to Understanding the Stock Market shows you precisely how to break down the numbers in an engaging and readable way with real-life examples. Get access today at stockmarketpdf.com. Until next time, have a prosperous day. The information contained is for general information and educational purposes only. It is not intended for a substitute for legal, commercial, and/or financial advice from a licensed professional. Review our full disclaimer at einvestingforbeginners.com.